All right. Turn with me to 2 Samuel chapter 6. 2 Samuel chapter 6. We're in the middle of a series on the life of King David in 1 and 2 Samuel, and I'm calling this series Faithfulness Through Adversity. You look at David's life, you look at Israel's life at that time, and you see a lot of adversity, a lot of challenges, and yet through that you see a faithfulness. David has this faithfulness towards his God, and of course God has this faithfulness to him. And I want to remind you where we've been so far. This is week 4. Week 1, we looked at the fact that Israel, as a nation, was experiencing adversity. They had these invaders challenging them, and they had really no leadership. And in the midst of that, they asked for a human king, which was not what God had, you know, originally said would be good for them. But they asked for a king. They wanted someone who would fight their battles for them. And so God gave them the king they asked for, King Saul. And we saw how Saul didn't obey God, and his kingship ended in disaster. And then week 2, we looked at the rising up of King David before he was king, and the great adversary Goliath, this giant who threatened Israel. And we saw how, in the midst of his fear, David found courage in the perspective that the battle belongs to the Lord. It's this great, you know, scene that we all know so well. And then last week, David faced some more adversity in the person of Saul. And he spent years of his life before he became king on the run from Saul. And we looked at this opportunity that he had to actually take revenge on Saul, to kill Saul, and take the kingship for himself. But he didn't do that. He had this perspective that vengeance was the Lord's, and that the Lord would reward him for his own faithfulness and righteousness. And so he didn't do that. This morning, we look at some more adversity. And this time, the adversity that David faces is God himself, God's own holiness. And that could be an adversity for us as sinful people, and yet we'll see what God does to solve that situation. This is a great scene. Many of you know this scene. This is a scene where David is bringing the ark into Jerusalem, and he as king is dancing with all his might before the Lord, and he just loses himself in this joy, and he's jumping and leaping and dancing in front of all the people, totally embarrassing himself, and he's expressing what I would call uninhibited joy. It's a joy that is without inhibition. It's where your body just expresses what your heart is feeling. And David, in that moment, that happens. And so he starts dancing before the Lord. And so I want to ask you, before I get into the passage, when was the last time that you experienced uninhibited joy? When was the last time you were just so full of joy that your body just wanted to do the thing that your heart was doing inside, whether that's for you dancing or jumping or just a yes, you know, just a big fist pump or what, you know, a big embrace? What is it? When was the last time you experienced uninhibited joy? And I thought about that for myself. I'll give you mine. You won't be surprised. About 2 months ago, what is it? There we go. I feel known here. I feel known. So I watched Game 7 at Mark Page's house, who was just doing announcements, if you don't know Mark, and Joel Owen, who was leading worship, was there. We do everything together. So we're at Mark's house watching this game. We're all big fans, and we had three quarters of what I would call uninhibited frustration, okay? And if those of you that saw the game, you know what it was. Just men saying things they should never say, acting in ways that they should never act. It was such that Tracy, Mark's wife, actually went in to another room and got the video camera and started recording our response to the game. Just this painful game and guys acting like little children. And then, of course, the fourth quarter comes, Ron hits his big three, and the game and Lakers win, and you saw what can only be called as uninhibited joy. Okay, just men again doing embarrassing things, you know, embracing for too long or just shouting too loud, you know, just uninhibited joy where your body is doing what your heart is doing. When's the last time you experienced uninhibited joy? You know, maybe it's a sporting event for some of you. Maybe it's maybe it's seeing your grandkid or your child score the winning goal in a game. Maybe it's something more serious. Maybe it's, you know, going in to get a test at the doctor's and coming home and finding out that the test results are favorable. It's just that, yes, thank you, or just that uninhibited joy. What was it for you? Well, we get to look at a scene where David is experiencing this uninhibited joy, dancing before the Lord. And I want to look at that and ask ourselves, why is he dancing? What's going on inside of him, and what can we learn from his joy in that experience? So chapter 6, so just to catch you up from where we were last week, Saul dies at the end of 1 Samuel, and then over the next 5 chapters, David becomes king, first of just one tribe, Judah, and then finally of all the tribes of Israel. So he is now in chapter 5, he becomes king of Israel, that thing he had been waiting for so long, he finally gets. He captures Jerusalem in chapter 5, and it becomes the capital city. So finally, the king is king, and he has a capital city, and now he wants to take the ark, which has been in another town, and bring it into God's capital city. So I want to read this passage in 2 parts today. The first, we'll see a lot of, this is really funny. I'm looking at my notes. That's really funny. So we save paper here at Grace, or at least I do. And so I was working on 2 sides of the paper, so the other side has other things, and I'm realizing this one already was double-sided, so I'm looking at notes that are completely unreadable. That's awesome. All right. Let's see. I think it's only 1 page. All right, that's good. All right. That's funny. Okay, so I'm going to read verses 1 through 11. You're going to see some adversity, and then we get to the joy in verses 12 through 23. So we'll start with verses 1 through 11. David again brought together out of Israel chosen men, 30,000 in all. He and all his men set out from Bala of Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim that are on the ark. They set the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart with the Ark of God on it, and Ahio was walking in front of it. David and the whole house of Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord, with songs and with harps, lyres, tambourines, sistrums, and cymbals. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark of God because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore, God struck him down, and he died there beside the ark of God. Then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah, and to this day that place is called Perez Uzzah, which means breaking out against Uzzah. David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, "How can the ark of the Lord ever come to me?" He was not willing to take the ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David. Instead, he took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. The ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, for 3 months, and the Lord blessed him and his entire household. All right, so that's part one of the scene. So David's going to come and bring the ark, and this tragic thing takes place. So let's talk about the Ark of the Covenant for a second, okay? Most of you know about this object. The ark was basically this wooden box that God had Israel make. It was about 4 feet by 2.5 feet, made of acacia wood, and then it was inlaid with gold inside and out. And then on the top, there was a cover that's called the mercy seat. And there are these two, it's pure gold, the cover's pure gold, and there are these two cherubim, these angelic-like creatures that were carved in pure gold, and their wings were overshadowing the cover. Okay, I don't need to tell you what it looked like. You've all seen the movie, right? So you know what the ark looks like. More important than what it looked like is what it represented. What did the ark represent? Anybody know? Yeah, God's presence, God's holy, powerful, awesome presence dwelling with his people. As you look at verse 2, how the ark is described, the second half of that verse, the ark which is called by the name of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim that are on the ark. So we're saying God is enthroned there. You know, kings sit on thrones. They've got a little footstool that they sit on. And the ark was basically God's throne. That's the place where God, the great king, dwelt. And we know that God, it was transcendent, that he fills heaven and earth, that heaven and earth can't contain him. And yet, God had chosen in some special way for his holy, awesome, powerful presence to dwell with his people. And the ark represented that presence. So you've got, really, it represents his holiness, the fact that God is this awesome, and we were singing about holiness, that God is this awesome God, and God gave them very specific details on how to make the ark and how to move the ark. They're real careful instructions. I think part of that, God was saying, hey, I'm a holy God, and I want you to be careful in how you treat me and how you deal in relationship with me. And God's holiness is this part of him that means he's set apart. He's totally set apart from anything that is wicked or evil. He is 100% pure goodness, which is this awesome thing, but a potentially terrifying thing if you are not 100% pure goodness. And the ark represents that holy presence of God. But it also represents his merciful presence with his people. Because the mercy seat, that cover, that's where the forgiveness of sins took place every year. And many of you know this story, but once a year, on Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, the high priest would go into the tabernacle, into the Holy of Holies, the holiest part of the tabernacle, and that's where the ark would reside. And he would bring a sacrifice, and he would sprinkle the blood of that sacrifice on the cover of the ark. And in light of that sacrifice, God would forgive the sins of the people for one more year. And many of you have heard the story, the traditional story, how they would actually tie a rope to the leg of the high priest as he'd go in, just in case God struck him down before or God wasn't happy with the sacrifice, so at least they could pull him out. That's the kind of represents the holiness of God and yet his desire to be merciful to his people. And so the ark is God's presence. The ark would lead the people out in battle. You remember when they went to the city of Jericho, they took the ark and they, you know, walked around the city all those days, and that was, you know, and then the walls came tumbling down. And it was God the King being present with his people. And so you can see why David would want to bring the ark into the capital city. And I think, yeah, he was making a public statement. On one hand, he was saying, hey, the ark, God's presence is going to be right at the center of this nation. It's not going to be on the side in some town somewhere, which is really where it was during Saul's reign, but he's saying God's presence is going to be at the center of our life, Israel. And I think beyond that, I think there was just a personal desire of David's to have God's presence in Israel. I think David just relished. He craved God's presence. And you know, you read the Psalms, you see a guy who, you know, my soul longs for your presence. My heart aches for your presence. And so David had this desire to bring the ark into the capital city. It was a good and right desire. So I want you to picture the scene, okay? You just heard me read it. Verses 1 through 5, you've got this festive occasion. David's got 30,000 warriors with him. They go to this city where the ark is, and there's all these musicians, as you know, and they start bringing the ark on this cart towards the capital city. And it's basically a parade. I mean, it's like the Laker parade, if you got to see that. You know, you got people lined up, so I couldn't help it. I just had to go there. Totally irreverent, sorry. So you got people, they're cheering, there's music, it's a great moment. The king is bringing God's ark into God's capital city. And then, as you heard me read, verse 6 and 7, you've got this guy, Uzzah, who is walking with the ark, and an oxen stumbles, and the cart's shaky, and he reaches out to steady the ark. And God, when he touches the ark, God strikes him down dead, and all of a sudden, in the middle of this parade, there's this dude lying on the ground, and he's dead. And it just happens like that. And everybody sees it. And I imagine that parade just comes to a screeching halt. The music dies down, and all of a sudden, you know, it's like the all-time buzzkill, basically. You know, all of a sudden, there's this guy lying on the ground dead, and the music stops, and everybody's wondering, oh my gosh, what do we do? Just total change of the ethos of the moment. And they decide, that everybody's probably filled with fear, and what they do is they decide, we'll have to just take, we can't bring the ark in to the capital city, so we'll just have to take it to someone's house nearby. So they kind of veer off, and they take it to the house of this guy, Obed-Edom, who I would be really afraid to be in that moment. But they just leave it there, and party's over. Parade is over, and you've got all these people who probably just walk back to their house, and I imagine they're walking back in silence, in awe and fear and full of confusion. And David is probably, you know, walking home thinking, what just happened? And the ark stays there for 3 months. It's 3 months before they go and bring it into the city. So I told you this passage is about joy. But before we get to the joy, we've got to sit with this, the reality of what has happened in this passage. And I want to just acknowledge, and maybe you felt it as you even heard me read it, this is one of those really hard passages, isn't it? You know, you've got this guy Uzzah, and he's just seemingly trying to do, you know, what's right. He's, you know, he sees the ark is kind of stumbling, and he's just trying to steady it, and he just gets wiped out for it because he touches the ark, and he's wiped out. And it seems totally unfair, seems harsh, and I mean, these are the kinds of passages. It's because of passages like these that a lot of people aren't Christians, right? I mean, they read passages like this, and they go, see, that's why I'm not a Christian, or why many of us as Christians struggle with God. You see this God, and you go, he seems so judgmental, so harsh sometimes, or he just seems unfair. I mean, he's erratic, he's unpredictable. Why here and not in other places? It seems so unfair. How do we reconcile this scene with a God that we see in the person of Jesus Christ? And so I think it's worth kind of sitting with for a couple minutes before we get to the joy. So if you don't mind, I'd like to do that. And what I'd like to do is first try to explain why I think God does this, try to defend God for a minute, which he needs no defending, but I'll do it anyways. And then I want to just have us ask some questions about ourselves in regard to our response to passages like this. All right, so what do you think God is doing here? Why does God do something that feels, at least to most of us, as really harsh and judgmental? I think that God is using this as an object lesson of sorts, that there's something really important about himself that he wants to reveal to his people at a very important time in their life. So it's kind of an object lesson. And as I've thought about this, David was actually being a bit presumptuous in what he was doing. And I think his heart was in a good place. It was a good desire to bring the ark in. But in his zeal, in his excitement, he actually didn't go back to the law and look at the ways that God had told him that the ark should be carried and moved. And if you go back to the law, you'll see that the ark was always supposed to be carried. It wasn't supposed to be put on a cart, and it was only carried by the Levitical priests. And God had told them, you need to design these wooden rods that the priests will carry, and there's a very specific way that I want you to do this. And in his zeal, David had totally ignored that. And that comes out, if you read 2 Chronicles, tells the same passage. And there, David actually, it includes some words that aren't included here. David actually says, he's talking to the priests, and he says, it's because you Levites, it's because we didn't have you guys bring it up the first time that the Lord's anger broke out against us. He says, we didn't inquire of him about how to do it in the prescribed way. And so David acknowledges, in my zeal, I hadn't sought the Lord's commandments. And so I think God, this is an object lesson, right at the beginning of David's kingship, where God is saying, hey, I'm a holy God, and there are certain things that I want you to do, and I want you to submit to me, and it's important that you know that. And maybe even Uzzah himself was being a bit presumptuous, and I'll just leave this thought with you. I was listening to a sermon on this passage, and the preacher said something really interesting. He said, Uzzah had misjudged the situation. He had assumed that the ark would be more defiled by touching the dirt on the ground than by touching him. Pretty interesting thought. He had assumed that the ark would be more defiled by touching the dirt on the ground than by touching him. He had misjudged the seriousness, the dirtiness of his own sin. And so maybe God was in an object lesson saying, hey, I am a holy God, and you guys need to be reminded of what happens when 100% pure holiness comes in contact with sin. And by definition, holiness is intolerant of sin. I want you guys to see the seriousness, the dirtiness of sin. And so at a very important time in Israel's life, right when David becomes king, God is saying, you guys need to remember something really important about me. Some of you are teachers in this room. Maybe you teach high school or you teach elementary school. I look at this as kind of like what you have to do on the first day of class. You know, first day of class, you're kind of setting the tone for the semester. And you might have to do some object lesson stuff in terms of this is how this classroom is going to function. And sometimes that first person that acts out, they kind of, as an object lesson, they take a little bit of the brunt of something. But it's for a good thing. It's saying, this is the way that we're going to do things. It's an object lesson. And God was saying, I want you guys, right at the beginning of this kingship, I want you to know something about me, that I am holy, and that you need to submit to me, and you need to recognize the seriousness of my holiness and your sin. So I don't know if that's satisfying to you or not, The other thing I just want to mention, rather than trying to explain God and defend him, is to have us sit with ourselves and in our own reaction to passages like this where we go, man, I don't like the God that I'm seeing here. And I read a book by Tim Keller called The Reason for God, and he made an interesting comment. He said, we have to allow for a God who's going to offend us from time to time. You know, we have to allow for a God who's going to offend our sensibilities from time to time. Because the truth is, right now, in this day and age, we're living in a culture that really doesn't stress the holiness of God, right? The transcendence, the power, the otherness of God. And a culture that really downplays the reality of sin, its ugliness, its seriousness. And so living in that culture, we look at a passage like this, and it shocks our sensibilities. We're maybe even offended by it. But the truth is, there's other cultures in the world right now or in other times that are offended by completely opposite things about God than what we're offended by. I mean, there's cultures that they see this idea of God's grace, that God just forgives people for all the things that they've done, whatever they've done. If they put their faith in Jesus Christ, he just forgives them. They don't have to earn a thing with him. They see that in their culture, and that's offensive to them. So my point is, who's to say that our sensibilities are always the right and correct and perfect sensibilities when it comes to reacting to God? And even if you put this in human terms, I mean, if you think of a human leader who is a good leader and is going to chart a course for a group of people and be courageous, say, this is right and get and do this, if they do that with courage, they're going to offend people on all sides from time to time. Why would it not be the case with the living God of the universe? And so this may not be a problem for you, but if it is, I would just ask you this morning this question. Do you have room for a God who is going to offend you from time to time? Do we have room for God who's not always going to do things the way we think he should do them? Because the other option is the really popular option out there today, and it's basically to create a God in our own likings and desires. To create a God that always does things the way that we think he should do things. And that's really popular right now. But when you think about it, how presumptuous is that? I need to believe in a God who never does things that are different than the way I think he should do things, who never offends me. No relationship works like that. And yet that's what's really popular these days. And of course, the God of choice right now is a God who's very soft on sin and whose holiness doesn't mean much. And yet the Bible consistently paints this picture of a God who's holy and awesome. And sometimes terrifying, but a God who cares deeply about sin, a God for whom sin matters. I want to read out loud the bulletin quote that I gave you. So many of you know it well. This is C.S. Lewis, the Christian author. This was his attempt to give a picture of this God who is holy. And he does it, of course, in the Chronicles of Narnia through the character of Aslan, who is a Christ figure. And I just want to read this little dialogue. This is when the four children, the human children, are first hearing about Aslan, this, you know, the king, this Christ figure, and they assumed he was a man. So Lucy says, "Is he a man?" asked Lucy, and they're talking to Mr. Beaver, who can speak, by the way. "Is he a man?" asked Lucy. "Aslan, a man?" said Mr. Beaver sternly. "Certainly not. I tell you, he's the king of the wood and the son of the great emperor beyond the sea. Don't you know who is the king of beasts? Aslan is a lion, the lion, the great lion." "Ooh," said Susan, "I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I shall feel rather nervous about meeting a lion." "That you will, dearie," said Mrs. Beaver. "If there's anyone who can appear before Aslan without their knees knocking, they're either braver than most or else just silly." "Then he isn't safe?" said Lucy. "Safe," said Mr. Beaver. "Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver tells you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good. He's the king, I tell you." It's this great picture of a lion that is not safe, but is good, 100% pure goodness, which can be a terrifying reality, depending on if you are 100% pure goodness or not. And I think David recognizes in this scene a God who isn't always safe, but who is good. And you see his response. First, there's an anger in him, but then in verse 9, look at verse 9, his response is fear, and that's the appropriate response. David was afraid of the Lord that day, and this is a great question. He said, "How can the ark of the Lord ever come to me? That's a great question. How can the ark of the Lord ever come to me? How can a holy God dwell with sinful people? And we need to feel the weight of that question. And David felt the weight of that question. All right, so there's the adversity. Now let's look at the joy. Let me read to you the second half of this passage, verse 12 through 23. Now King David was told, "The Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the ark of God." So David went down again and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. When those who were carrying the ark of the Lord had taken six steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all his might, while he and the entire house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. As the ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, I'll call her Michal. It's probably Michal, but I'll say Michal. Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. They brought the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. After he had finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of dates. Nice, my wife loves dates. She should make a date cake. That's great. A cake of dates and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd of Israel, both men and women. And all the people went to their homes. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "My, how the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, disrobing in the sight of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would." David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor." And Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. Wow. So, we turn from the adversity to the joy that we see here. So again, I want you to picture the scene. So verse 12 tells us that the Lord blessed Obed-Edom's house, and I think David sees that as a sign from God that God's favor is upon him, and I think that's accurate. So they go down again, and this is kind of a do-over. We're going to try this again. And this time they do it right. As you look at verse 13, there's people carrying the ark, and I'm quite sure that those are the Levitical priests. So I'm not sure exactly what happens here, but it says they take six steps, and my assumption is those were really nervous steps, okay? You know, it's kind of one step, everybody's still alive? Okay, two steps, three steps, and everybody's on tiptoe. Yeah, I'm sure the crowd is silent. And then they get to six, and my assumption here is at that point they realize, okay, God is blessing this. God is allowing his presence to come into the capital city. And so they sacrifice an animal either to appease God or maybe just as an act of celebration. And then I think the celebration is on. They realize God is for this, and the place, you know, starts going, and the music starts, and there's cheering, and the parade goes on again. And then in verse 14 and 15, you have this amazing picture of David dancing, as it says, dancing before the Lord with all his might, leaping, jumping, dancing. In case you're wondering, this was not like an expected role of the king, okay? There's nothing in the law that says, you know, when the ark is brought in, the king should dance before the Lord, okay? This is David doing actually the last thing you'd expect a king to do. Guy who's totally unselfconscious, just in his joy, he just starts dancing, and he's jumping, and he's doing this in front of all of his subjects. It's not a very dignified, not a very respectable thing to do, and yet he's filled with this, what I'm calling uninhibited joy. And he's just dancing. And as I see it, this joy is a response to God's grace in his life. You know, he's seen this holy, awesome God, and yet now this holy, awesome God is choosing to bless him. He's choosing to bring his presence into the capital city where David is. And David now realizes God's presence is not something that I can grab or take in my own way, but it comes to me now as a sheer gift, as sheer grace from God himself. And he's just overcome in that moment with what God is doing in his life, and he just starts dancing. It's this beautiful picture of uninhibited joy. Well, we have a little bit more adversity, as you heard, from David's wife, Michal. And it's interesting, she's not called David's wife. Three times in this passage, she's called Saul's daughter. And I think the narrator is reminding us, she represents Saul, really, his reign in this passage. The jealousy towards David, and of course, a reign where God was not at the center. And in verse 16, she sees the king dancing in front of all these women, in front of everybody, and she looks at it and it says she despised him. She's embarrassed, she's jealous, she despises him. And then in verse 20, she makes a comment to David that is just, you know, dripping with sarcasm. And she says, "My, wow, how you have distinguished yourself today among the women." And, you know, David's wearing a robe. He probably isn't wearing underwear. And her, you know, implication is he's jumping up and down, and maybe people are seeing a little bit more of David than they should, okay? And we don't know if that's true or if that's just what, you know, that's what she's saying here. And she despises him. And David's response is great. You look at it in verse 21 and 22. He basically says, let me tell you who I was dancing for, and let me tell you why I was dancing. So verse 21, he says, you know what? It was before the Lord. I was celebrating before the Lord. God was my audience. I wasn't out there dancing to impress people. I was dancing because God was my audience. In verse 22, he goes, hey, I'll become more undignified than this. I'm willing to embarrass myself more than this if it means praising my God. I don't know how many of you are dancers out there. I happen to know a dancer, and she loves to dance. But, you know, there's two kinds of dancers, and you can kind of tell as you get on the dance floor. There's people who are dancing to impress people, or at least to not embarrass themselves. That's me, and they're self-conscious, and they're aware. And then there's people who just dance for the sake of dancing. And you can tell the difference. And those are the people, they'd be out there if nobody else was out on the dance floor. They're just dancing for the sake of dancing. And I look at David here, and he's that latter category. Say, hey, I'm dancing before the Lord. I'm not dancing to impress all these people. He's my audience. And then he says in verse 21, he says why he's dancing. He says, look at it, verse 21, it was before the Lord who chose me, and then maybe this is a little dig, I don't know, rather than your father, possibly. but he's saying, you know, the Lord has chosen me, this holy, transcendent, awesome God, for reasons that I'll never fully understand, he's chosen me. He's chosen me to be king over his people. And it's just, it's an amazing thing. I didn't do anything to deserve it, and yet he has chosen me. He's been gracious to me. This God who is so strong, he's on my side, and that's why I'm dancing. I'm struck by his grace. And he doesn't even know how true that's going to be, but if we were to read chapter 7, you see that even more. And chapter 7 is really a high point in the Old Testament. David goes on to bring the ark in, and then he says, I want to build a house for the ark, for God. I want to build a temple. And God goes on to tell him, it's not for you to build a house for me, but let me tell you what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to build a house for you. And there he means his family, his lineage. He says, I'm going to build a house for you, and one of your descendants is going to sit on the throne forever. I'm not going to do to your family what I did to Saul's family, but your family is going to be the chosen family. And so he gets this even bigger picture of God's grace that will last forever. And of course, we know that's fulfilled in Jesus Christ, the great king, the son of David. And so David is overwhelmed that this holy, awesome, unsafe God has chosen him, has chosen to bless him. And that's why he's dancing. And with that, the conversation comes to an end and the scene comes to an end. So there you have it. You've got this guy, David, this king who experienced grace from a holy God, and as a result, he was filled with this uninhibited joy. And I was thinking about him today and that picture of him dancing, and I thought, what a great model for us. Isn't that a great model for us today? I mean, because the gospel is that we have experienced the grace of this wild, holy God. We've got this holy God who's not safe, who's not tame, who is 100% pure goodness, intolerant of evil, and God cares just as much about sin today as he did 3,000 years ago, okay? He's not getting soft on sin in his old age. He still cares just as much. And yet this God, out of his love and his mercy, sent his son, the son of David, to be the sacrifice for our sin, for our dirtiness. And just as the blood was sprinkled on the cover of the ark, Christ's blood as a sacrificial lamb was poured out for us, so that we have grace from this holy God. We now have peace with God. And in the first instance, for me, that's just cause for relief. You know, I mean, I think the Israelites, that they experienced relief. God, this holy God is not going to, he's not going to take us down. We have peace. There's no condemnation anymore. And we get to experience God's presence, that thing that David craved. We have, God has sent his own Holy Spirit into our lives. We have the presence of this holy God, and we have God's power. Now, this power that could take us down is now working in the universe for our good. He's working all things in our lives, ultimately, for our good. We have that kind of power. You know, I think, again, of the image of Aslan, this lion who is strong and terrifying. But on the other hand, what if Aslan's on your side? You know, I mean, what's life like if Aslan is on your side? What could possibly happen to you ultimately? You've got Aslan on your side. And that's, of course, what Paul says in Romans 8. He says, if God's for us, who could possibly be against us? This holy, awesome God is on our side, and he's working all things for our good. We have his peace, we have his presence, we have his power, and it's all by his grace. It all comes to us as sheer gift through his son, Jesus Christ. And the appropriate response for us is joy. Uninhibited joy. And if you're a Christian here this morning, there have been moments, I'm sure, in your life where you have experienced that uninhibited joy. I know it's not every day, but there's times where we experience just the uninhibited joy of the gospel. I remember for myself, I remember actually being in Israel, being on the Sea of Galilee one morning by myself, and I was walking along the Sea of Galilee, and I was just struck by the fact that I was there and the life that God had given me and the fact that he had saved me, and just the moment was just so overwhelming. I was overwhelmed by grace, and I just started running and kind of skipping, and it was like the first time I wasn't running for exercise. I was just kind of running around, skipping around in the water, jumping around, and just a lot of this, you know, and I totally embarrassed myself if anybody was watching that. And we've all had those moments. For some of you, I'm sure the car is that moment. You know, the windows are rolled up, and maybe you're listening to some worship, and you're just struck either by the, you know, the beauty of what you're seeing, but or the words of the song reminding you who God is, and you just break out into just singing loud. And you're going for it, and you're embarrassing yourself if people are driving past you, but you don't care because you're just struck by grace in that moment. That's an appropriate response to the gospel. So I want to leave you with this question. Are we living lives that reflect that wild grace of God? And I want to ask, you might be in one of two places. Maybe this morning you're in a place where maybe you just need to come to terms with God's holiness a little bit more. You know, maybe you're a person, you see these scenes where God's holiness shows up and his judgment shows up, and you see, you know, I can't believe in a God who would do that. I can't do that. And so maybe what you've done is you've kind of created a God who is more to your liking, but who isn't really the God of the Bible. And the most popular version out there these days is a God who's soft on sin. And maybe that even is reflected in your life, and you don't really pursue holiness fully. You don't think it's that big of a deal. And so maybe today you just need to sit and have a conversation with God and say, God, you know, this is really hard for me, this part of you, and I want you to be something else. But at the same time, I want to know you as you really are. I don't want to make you up in my mind. I want to know you for who you really are. Because the truth is, if we don't come to terms with God's holiness, there's something in our lives that will be compromised. And you know what it is? It's joy. Because you can never experience the joy of the gospel, of God's grace, until you experience the reality of his holiness and his power. And so you look at the culture today, and you have people who just don't think much about the gospel, because the gospel is, there's this really big problem. God's really holy, and we're really not. And that's a really big problem, and God has created this really incredible solution through Jesus Christ. But the culture today looks and says, there's not really a problem. What's the problem? So what's there to celebrate? So maybe you need to just sit with God and come to terms with this. And then secondly, I end with you guys. Maybe this morning you just need to be reminded of God's wild grace, and you need to just rejoice in it in some way. Maybe you're like me. You still live a life that is very cautious, very careful and controlled, very self-aware. And you just need to be reminded of God's grace. Or maybe you're just going through a really hard time right now. and circumstances are tough, and you just need to be reminded that this wild God has chosen to be gracious to us in Jesus Christ, and you need to celebrate. I want to close with part of a poem from a Christian author named Denise Levertov. I'm not going to read the whole poem. The poem's called To Live in the Mercy of God. And she says, oh, to live in the mercy of God. And she says, it should produce awe, not comfort. There's this awe that comes when we recognize God's mercy. And then awe suddenly passing beyond itself becomes a form of comfort. It becomes the steady air you glide on, arms stretched out like wings. And it's a picture of us just kind of floating in God's grace. And then she gives an image of God's grace like the sea, like the ocean, to float upheld as salt water would hold you once you dared. And this picture of us just floating in salt water as if we're floating in God's grace. And then she gives one final image of God's grace, and it's the image of a waterfall, that God's grace is like just this torrent of water going down onto these rocks below, and we're like the rocks, and God's grace is like the water coming, flinging on us. Just to live in the mercy of God, to feel the waterfall flinging itself down and down to clenched fists of rock. And then she ends this way. Thus, not mild, not temperate is God's love for the world. A vast flood of mercy flung on resistance. And it's this picture of this God who pours out this wild grace on us. And yet we can be like these clenched fists of rock resisting his grace. And so it's this encouragement to open ourselves to the grace of God and to recognize that it's all by his grace and his sheer grace and to celebrate it with uninhibited joy. So where in your life today do you need to just experience the grace of God? Let's pray. I'm going to pray Paul's prayer in Ephesians, where he prays for the Ephesians to know what a great thing they have in God. So let me pray this for us. For this reason, ever since I heard about your faith in the Lord Jesus and your love for all the saints, I have not stopped giving thanks for you, remembering you in my prayers. And this is a prayer for us today. I keep asking the God of our Lord Jesus Christ, the glorious Father, that he may give you the spirit of wisdom and revelation so that you may know him better. And I pray that the eyes of your heart will be enlightened so that you may know the hope to which he's called you, the riches of his glorious inheritance in the saints, and his incomparably great power for us who believe. Lord Jesus, we want to know your grace this morning. We want to know your presence. We want to know your power. So work in our hearts. I pray this in your name. Amen.